spoiler phobes, you have stumbled into a storm of spoilers, a Star Wars special where we are covering the Star Wars streaming series Andor, which burned brightly and briefly for two seasons on Disney Plus. This week, we are focusing on what Andor accomplished and giving out some awards to our favorite superlatives. But discussion could expand to include Star Wars movies, Star Wars TV shows, Star Wars novels, Star Wars comics and video games, maybe, you know, the Star Wars universe. No storm section this week because Andor is finished. We're not ruining, we're enriching, and we're building a rebellion. Hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez, and ignite the spark.
And I'm Neil Miller, and light the fire.
And welcome back to a storm of spoilers. Just letting you know where you could find more of us on this podcast really quick at the beginning. We are going to be doing one more Star Wars episodes to wrap up our Andor season 2 coverage. Next week, the 23rd of July, you will get a new episode. We're going to be examining the existing Star Wars and how political it has been, even back when George Lucas was using it to develop new filmmaking technology. Then on the final week of July, we're going to pivot to a new series and take a week off. We might resurface our Star Wars Rogue One special we recorded with Joanna Robinson right when that movie came out. Just know that that was a contemporary podcast and will be a reissue. Then we'll be back in August. Surprise! Storm of Spoilers will be covering Alien Earth. It is a Hulu series. It is, I think, technically our first Alien franchise television series. Who knows what it actually is, though? Both the Alien and the Predator franchises have been having a very interesting year this year. We're going to be covering it week to week here on Storm of Spoilers. So if you want to stick around and stick in space with us, we will be going from a galaxy far, far away to our galaxy terrorized by xenomorphs. Join us for Storm of Spoilers, Alien Earth in August. If you would like to support the show or get in touch with us, you can email us at stormofspoilers@gmail.com with whatevs. You can review us on the iTunes app or the Apple Podcast app, it's called, or Spotify. There you could leave us a 5-star rating. We love that because it helps us find new people. You could also leave us a review or a comment. For instance, Two Tone wrote this week, "These guys put together a great podcast that doesn't take itself too seriously. I have a lot of fun listening to them each week." That is very true. Neil and I do not take ourselves too seriously.
Except for this week. I'm going to be very serious.
Oh, well, spoilers alert. Well, guess what? Neil might be serious. I'm certainly not. We're on YouTube now. If you head to youtube.com/@DA7EANDEDIL, that's at Dave and Neil, how I spell my name, Dave, you will find full video episodes of this podcast, and you will get to see my U.S. Space Camp shirt that I wore when I went to space camp when I was 12. That's how unserious I am this week to balance out Neil's seriousness. If you like what we're laying down, you could get more of us at patreon.com/Dave and Neil. That's DA7EANDNEIL. We've got bonus content from previous seasons of Storm of Spoilers, not just this one. That includes our Lost Rewatch series, which a lot of people liked. And you could just find all of that if you scroll back on your Storm of Spoilers feed. Plus, we have complete series podcasts over at our Patreon for Twin Peaks. Neil and I did Twin Peaks. We watched Let the Mystery Be a Leftovers Watch. And right now we are watching the series Hannibal. Can't believe it aired on NBC. So gory, as we do Eat the Rude, a Hannibal rewatch. Make sure to check us out at patreon.com/Dave and Neil. Not only do you get access to all of those things, but we have a Slack where you could talk with our community. And we have weekly pop culture adventure episodes where Neil and I talk about various pop culture news and movies and look deep into what makes filmmaking special, or in this case, problematic, since this month we're doing Fantastic Four movies, and only like two of those were easy productions.
This episode of Storm of Spoilers is brought to you by Indivisible. If you attended the No Kings protest a few weeks ago, you probably saw signs referencing Andor. I saw a lot of people carrying "I have friends everywhere" signs, and Tony Gilroy made no secret about his participation in the protest in New York.
Andor might be taking place in a galaxy far, far away, but the connections to what's happening in this country are inescapable. We're seeing a steady march by a tyrannical regime against our communities and our rights. They hide behind countless atrocities, but we know oppression is the mask of fear. They know there are more of us, and regular people are already rising up with acts big and small to defend their neighbors and what remains of our aspiring democracy. One organization that's helping people throughout the country enlist in the cause is Indivisible. They are the primary group behind the No Kings protest and a daily source of actions people can take to overcome this fascist onslaught.
Indivisible has grassroots groups working day in and day out in every corner of our country to protect our rights and find meaningful ways to defy the Trump regime. Visit their website at indivisible.org to get connected, join a local group, or enroll in their trainings on strategic defiance to fight authoritarianism. You can also sign up at indivisible.org/friendseverywhere for more info.
All right, that's all the housekeeping. Let's kick off our actual Storm of Spoilers episode with a little bit of a retrospective of Andor. We're going to be talking about both seasons, even though season two just ended, because I do think it's interesting to do a post-mortem on Andor, the TV series. We are not a huge post-mortem podcast, Neil.
We
occasionally get to the end of things, but you and I maybe get to do like an actual, this is the end, there won't be a sequel, these are the last time we're going to see these characters, maybe like once every other year.
Well, you know, Dave, it's rare that things actually end in this era.
True.
So usually it's like, oh, well, we don't know if we're going to see these characters. And you know what? We're going to do a little bit of that with Andor, I'm sure, where we're like, we don't know if we're going to see some of these characters again. But for our main guy, for Cassian, we know where he ends up because there's a whole movie about it. So, yeah, it's kind of nice to be able to talk about something that is like a self-contained Star Wars adventure.
Yeah,
that has an ending.
I was looking back into how Andor got started because I did live through it. We did live through it, but the memory is hazy. And I had forgotten that basically until 2020, this was a first announced as possibly being a project as early as like late 2017. But Tony Gilroy wasn't attached until 2020. They were trying to produce it at just like a spy based Rogue One prequel series without Tony Gilroy. And for those of you that don't know, or maybe it's been quite a bit of distance from Rogue One, Rogue One is not a Tony Gilroy movie. It's a Gareth Evans movie. Mm-hmm. But Tony Gilroy did come in and help with the reshoots and sort of the restructuring of it. After some internal testing at Lucasfilm didn't do too well. Do you think that Tony Gilroy has sort of reclaimed this grouping of characters through Andor, whereas maybe he was just a savior of Rogue One when it came out?
I mean, reclaimed is an interesting word because I feel like there was just sort of a point where Tony Gilroy reached out into the ether and just sort of took these characters.
Right.
You know, I remember very distinctly 2016, the release of Rogue One, and going to that junket and sitting down with Gareth Edwards and talking to him as he was promoting the movie and getting this sort of vibe that he was proud of the final movie that they put out, but that he was ready to sort of wash his hands of the whole scenario. And like, you just kind of got the vibe that he wasn't ever going to come back and do anything more with these characters. So it actually kind of left Tony Gilroy in a very advantageous position, right? He's the guy who came in and helped save Rogue One from whatever disaster awaited it before they did the reshoots. And then, you know, as they were kind of developing this, they were developing it with Stephen Schiff, who was like, I believe he was a writer on The Americans, most notably, before this. And so, like, when that started to fall apart and they, you know, started reaching out to Tony, you can only imagine Tony Gilroy was like, all right, I'm in a position of power here. I can come in and be the guy who takes back control of these characters. And he did this rare thing in Hollywood. He seems to have, one way or another, weaved slash negotiated himself into a position where he kind of got full authorial control over two seasons of a very expensive Star Wars property.
Yeah.
And like, to the extent where he's like rewriting canon of K2SO's origin story without giving a shit about the previous canon, and he kind of just got to go off and do his own thing. So it's like this very unique situation that Tony Gilroy worked himself into. And, you know, I, to Kathleen Kennedy and everybody else at Lucasfilm's credit, they picked the right guy. right? Like Tony Gilroy, very talented. If you've ever seen Michael Clayton, he wrote the Bourne movies. Like he's legit. He's been legit for a long time.
I don't know if he wrote the Bourne movies is the best example of him doing good writing. I agree, Michael Clayton. I think
those are pretty well-written movies. Well, weren't especially they like, the first one.
Weren't they like historically like incident written? So they would like throw out the script after they got greenlit and sort of like jammed it.
Michael Clayton's a better example.
Yeah, Michael Clayton's a perfect example. You know, I don't think you need to go deeper than Michael Clayton.
Because he got nominated for an Oscar for that one.
Yes. So. And it is interesting to me that like sort of also because COVID, I don't think Tony Gilroy actually ended up directing any of the first season. Mm-hmm. I know he was supposed to direct the pilot, but he had to give that up because of some COVID travel restrictions at the time they were filming it. But yeah, Tony Gilroy is a really interesting creative to me because I do think he's been making some good choices. I think he made a very distinctive Star Wars, but he made a very distinctive Star Wars. And at least anecdotally, I've heard people talk about this sort of as Tony Gilroy's series, maybe because, you know, he employs family members. And I think
sure,
if nepotism works, all we have to do is point to it and you could draw your own conclusions. But like, it is very interesting that like Tony Gilroy basically like never really directed a Star Wars, but now sort of there's a bunch of pre-Yavin characters that I would consider Tony Gilroy characters, which is I think more a testament to how good Andor ended up being than it is necessarily about credits and deals.
Sure. Well, and it's a very difficult thing to make a Star Wars thing that is uniquely your own as a creator that is not immediately sort of ripped apart, I guess. Right. I mean, I compare it to like Rian Johnson,
right?
Who made this brilliant thing in my mind, The Last Jedi, who immediately then has J.J. Abrams come in and like left turn the whole franchise. Now, these are Star Wars movies, so it's a much bigger ship to turn. And Tony Gilroy is working with the advantage of knowing his endpoint of Rogue One, but it is kind of a unique thing to be able to play in this sandbox and get to do your own thing and know that no one's going to come along and make huge sweeping changes to it in the sequel. And I kind of like that for him. I'm happy for Tony Gilroy.
Yeah, I do agree that he maybe was aided by the closed nature, which is sort of how we started this conversation, where it's just like we at least know Andor's beginning, middle, and end. Now we won't think about the sister too much, I guess, but other than that, I think we have a good beginning, middle, and end. Also, Andor was part of the initial announcement by Kathleen Kennedy of like, here Lucasfilm is coming to Disney Plus, here's like our series that we're doing. Andor was one of them. Since it's been produced, Disney Plus seems to have been switching strategies with its sub brands. Like there's a lot you could say about Marvel, there's a lot you could say about Pixar, but definitely with Star Wars, a lot of these have not been the Mandalorian clones they were hoping for, ratings wise, merchandising wise. So it sort of feels like Andor season 2 was going to be all we got of Andor anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, now that we're 10 years into, as because the Force Awakens anniversary is this December. So now that we're 10 years into the Disney strategy of Star Wars, do you think Andor is an example of just like a road they never took? Or do you think Andor should maybe point the direction that we should go in rather than something like Ahsoka season 2?
Well, I think it depends, right? It depends on what you're going for. Right. Okay. Are you going for, is it about achieving things artistically or is it about achieving things commercially? So I think commercially, a lot of these companies, Disney very specifically, have put themselves in this weird box where they're making these, regardless of how expensive they are, streaming shows, they're very hard to quantify whether they're successful or not. Right. Because like Disney makes a shitload of money on your Disney Plus subscriptions every month. But we don't know how much of that actually like is fueled by Andor being good. And I don't, Disney might know, but I also kind of think they don't know. And I think that makes it infinitely harder for them and for everyone else to know if a series like Andor, being prestige and winning Emmys and getting 96% on Rotten Tomatoes, whether that moves the needle on like making Disney profit. Mm. And, you know, whether you care about that is a whole nother thing. But then there's this like artistic goal, this artistic virtue that they have to decide whether they want. And I do feel like it's like this fork in the road for Star Wars. It's like, do you want to make Star Wars shows that have something on their mind and that have something to say and that are interested in, you know, the conversations to a large extent that George Lucas was very interested in when he made the first Star Wars, right? I mean, George Lucas wanted to do big special effects. He wanted to do serialized action. He wanted to do all this stuff. But he also, again, was making like a movie about the Viet Cong. That is what this is. This is a Star Wars thing that has something to say. On the other side, I think you have the Dave Filoni vision, which is, do you want your trinkets? Mm-hmm. Do you want the characters you recognize in live action? Do you want to be counting the colors of the lightsabers? Do you want to be, you know, picking out the Easter eggs, right? Do you want to be concerned with where Luke Skywalker is going to show up and stuff like that? Like, do you want the trinkets or do you want Star Wars that has something to say? They haven't quite found a middle ground yet. And I do feel like that's the decision that Lucasfilm is going to have to make. Now, they do seem to be finding different levels of success in those two directions, right? In mm-hmm. one direction, you have The Mandalorian, which is a merchandising powerhouse that is now spawning a movie. And it's mostly because of the little guy, right?
Yeah.
It's like one character worked so well that he's now a plush toy for every kid. And that they're like riding that high. And then over here you have Andor, which is a very expensive, obviously expensive, beautifully crafted, meticulously sewn together series that everyone is like, this is the most artful Star Wars shit we have gotten yet. But then there's all this like undergirding where it's like, yeah, but did it really make any money for them? Like, was it worth spending all that money on? And it comes back to this, you know, capitalism then gets in the way of something like Andor. If it's me, if I'm in charge of Lucasfilm, if I'm Kathleen Kennedy, I would continually argue to the board of Disney that making good art is not always profitable and that we should continue trying to make more Andors if we can, right? Make more Andors. Because then people will continue to take what we're doing seriously. And sure, we'll make more Mandalorians as well to try and sell toys and breed spinoffs and movies and whatnot. But, you know, I think they have to find a way to either strike a middle ground or continue making both. Where the argument gets interesting is that we are talking about Disney, a company with plenty of money to do all of the things.
Yeah.
And I do think it will be interesting to see where Disney decides, how Disney decides if Andor was successful, what lessons they take from that and what that means going forward. Because, I was looking at the projects in development, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, what does this mean for Star Wars television? It's like, what is Star Wars television going forward, other than like Ahsoka season 2, mm-hmm. maybe some more Mandalorian?
I don't think we're getting any more TV Mandalorian.
Like the Mandalorian's getting a movie, and if that's successful, I assume we'll get another movie, because you know what makes a lot of money? Movies.
Yeah.
In theaters. So it's like, I don't know, man. It is hard to see how they go forward in the streaming era making TV shows like this. It is entirely plausible to me that we look back 10 years from now and be like, man, remember how good we had it when they were just throwing money at Tony Gilroy to make this crazy prestige show that they just put on Disney Plus and gave it to us. You know, for our, you know, $15 a month Disney Plus subscription, because I don't know if Disney will allow, I don't know if the profit chasing side of Disney will allow them to make a whole bunch more shows like this. I think it's, you hope they do, but I don't know if you know, they always learn the wrong lessons. And again, Lucasfilm and Disney are notorious for learning the wrong lessons.
Yes, that's true.
So you know, I'm not confident.
I would be more interested just if this opened the door to, because I do think it's unique in that most Star Wars content under George Lucas was for everybody, including mm-hmm. children, like sure. maybe not young children, but definitely like 9 to 13. They want that Star Wars child to engage with the Star Wars. George Lucas was interested in making Star Wars Underworld. That was supposed to be the first live action television series. And my understanding from what he said about that, what Ron Moore said about that, since they wrote all of it, they just didn't produce it, was that that was a little bit more Sopranos influence. So that was something that was maybe for quote unquote adults.
Sure.
But as it is, I think Andor is the only thing that I could point to and be like, this is for adults. Not, and it's not for adults like we aged into adults. Like I think a lot of Ahsoka fans were Ahsoka fans then and yeah. are now adults. But Andor is very specifically like nobody was 9 in 2016 and is now like a fully socially conscious being. But I do think there are people like you and me who were, you know, full on adults when Andor showed up and were surprised in the first season. And I think impressed in the second season with how little Andor talked down. This is the the first Star Wars on screen sexual assault, which is like a fucked up thing to use as a metric. But it's on Disney Plus. It's a Disney Plus show. It's not a Hulu show that you could get on Disney Plus. It's a Disney Plus show.
It's right next to the Skeleton Crew, which is very much a show for kids. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to Star Wars movies and the need to get a huge box office lift, those do have to be four quadrant experiences, right? Mandalorian and Grogu is going to be a movie that should appeal widely across the spectrum of ages. But I do think if they do it right, you could make TV shows that are specifically for the adult audience, just like you could make animated shows that are specifically for kids out of the Star Wars properties. Or, you know, you could have the Skeleton Crew, which we both enjoyed and was definitely a show for kids for the most part, or like teens. And I think that it just, Star Wars is in this weird place where it's like, the strategy doesn't seem to be cohesive across the board. It does feel like they're kind of trying things, and the thing I like is that there is a certain amount of trust being given to specific creators, which is good. It works out really well when you're giving Tony Gilroy some power. It gets a little much when you give like a lot of power to Dave Filoni and just let him go crazy. Right. But I think, you know, that impulse is something I would like to see them continue. Right. Like one of the projects they have in development is like a Carlton Cuse, Nick Cuse series. And I feel like that's the only one on the horizon for Star Wars that I could see being anywhere near an Andor. Right. It comes from, you know, a father-son duo that has worked in prestige television, right? Carlton Cuse, obviously co-showrunner of Lost. Nick Cuse, his son, who did quite a bit on The Leftovers, which we just finished watching. And you could see a scenario, depending on where in the Star Wars universe they're playing, where they make, you know, a thoughtful, adult, mature drama inside the Star Wars universe like this. It just depends on how much Disney's willing to invest in that, given that we kind of know once they put on Disney Plus, it's going to be difficult for them to get a huge return on that, right? It's not like a movie, and it's going to be also difficult for them to know what the return is other than just like how many people watched it. Those people who are already paying for their subscriptions. So, you know, it's weird. Star Wars is in a very weird place, man.
Like, it is.
It feels like if you're not Dave Filoni, you're not really getting a whole lot made these days. And Tony Gilroy seems to have kind of like slipped in there and benefited from like making a really, really smart series with like the hottest people he could find.
Right? I will tell you a rumor that I've heard, Neil, and I can't tell you where I've heard it from, but I've heard this. Which is that the reason why it seems like Tony Gilroy sneaked this in is for the past couple of years, this period in Star Wars history is just off fucking limits. They're like, we've done enough with the original trilogy. Mm. Like, don't pitch us stuff here. I know for sure two movies that were pitched to them in this time period that were basically shut down in like words, lesser words, because they were like, we're not doing it there. We want something that we could own. We want something post Rey. So sure. Andor might be the last drops that we get from this little fill in. They were definitely trying to also go, you know, pre Republic. And that didn't really work out with the Acolyte, but they are still letting James Mangold do something in that space.
The Acolyte's another really good point, because it's like the Acolyte tried something, right? Yeah. And it was a fairly adult show. And they gave up on it, basically. It seemed like they gave up on The Acolyte as they were releasing The Acolyte. So again, it's hard to know what, it's hard to see what Lucasfilm is committing to and see what is really working, especially in the streaming era. It was like, I went and I was like, trying to look up the data on how many people actually watched Andor. Mm-hmm. And it is the most complicated web of bullshit to try and unpack how many people actually watched it and how that compares to, you know, how many people watched like The Last of Us, for example, on a, like a linear cable network. So I think part of it is just the streaming era is so difficult to tell. Then again, I'm a dude with just the internet. Disney actually has analytics from Disney Plus, so they should be much better at it. But, you know, when you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on something, you do want to get your money's worth. Then again, I'm a big proponent of who cares how much it costs. It's Disney's money. Keep spending it. So,
yes, I'm in that for Disney for sure. It's also been difficult. Well, I mean, it's been fun covering Andor after Andor aired, but it's also been difficult to find that sort of data. I also thought we would have it, but I do think a lot of it is being obscured because we're recording this Monday, July 14th, Tuesday morning, tomorrow morning are the Emmy announcements. Mm-hmm. Andor needs a little bit of score, I think, because I thought Andor season two dropping over 4 weeks, basically like 90 minutes or more a week worth of content, seemed like they could have been burning it off. But the more people I talk to who are deeper in television, they're like, no, they're getting hyped for these Emmy nominations. They're getting in before The Bear. They're getting in before Squid Game 3 to come in here and do these Emmy nominations. So we're about to see if that pays off. I do think there's a possibility that things are a little brighter on the Disney's Star Wars television strategy if Andor gets some nominations.
Right.
Because that would at least show if Disney can play in the prestige TV era, I think that would be a place that they would love to be. That's Marvel getting a Best Picture nomination for Black Panther. Like, that's what Disney needs with like Star Wars television.
If you can both sell popcorn and win awards, that's the sweet spot. And that's you don't have to do it with the same property every time, right? Disney can, Lucasfilm can do that with two different things. They can let the Grogu sell the popcorn, and they can let Andor win the awards. That's completely fine. It's about sort of being able to say, look at all of the stuff that Star Wars is doing in television. And I think that is kind of important, because right now Star Wars television is the only Star Wars thing.
That's another thing.
Until we get another Star Wars movie, which, you know, they're working on it, but
I'm surprised we're this
even
far.
Even that is a TV show.
I mean, it's going to be The Mandalorian movie. And Grogu, but I think it's like still like either the end of next year or 2027. Like, we're not close to it.
Yeah.
So it is kind of amazing that we're filling
May
this
2026, according to this article.
Reading. Good. So we're closer than I thought we were, sure. But not this year, even though I'm pretty sure it's done. Not here or there. Yeah. So I guess with this whole Disney Star Wars television experiment, now that they've, I mean, the biggest thing that I think happened with Disney television and Star Wars was up until The Mandalorian, all Star Wars marketing for Disney was like, and here's how it connects back to Darth Vader. Like Darth Vader was the selling point. Like at The Force Awakens, in The Last Jedi, they were like really marketing towards that sort of like Darth Vader thing. It switched to Palpatine for Rise of Skywalker for reasons, but they finally have their own little money machine. And it's little Grogu. And so I think that at least right now is the legacy of streaming Star Wars. I hope at the end of this year, we're still talking about Andor season two, because that I think would be the bulwark.
Well, and I don't want to give too much credit to Dave Filoni on this one, but I almost want to say that the success of The Mandalorian and Grogu has helped them get a little bit out of this mindset that everything has to be tied to the Skywalker saga. And the more they get out of that mindset, the closer we get to stuff like Andor. Because I do think that one of the huge benefits of Andor is that they didn't take the bait on any like huge cameos, right? Like they didn't even go for Darth Vader, which Rogue One, you know,
or Palpatine, which I guess they were leaning towards at some point.
They didn't go for Palpatine. There's no Jedi, right? That we get like one mention of the Force, and it's Bail Organa, like at the very end. He's like, may the Force be with you. And Cassian's like, oh yeah, all right, bud. I'm like, I'm gonna go do like real shit over here. So like this idea that you can tell a story within this world that is about the rebellion, that is about people, that is specifically about like the cultures of these planets. Like the thing that kept coming into my mind is like Andor didn't just visit new biomes in the Star Wars universe, as we've constantly asking for. It instilled in us what these cultures are, right? I remember the culture of Ferrix and the Bricks. I think about, you know, the Chandrillan marriage culture that they have. You know, I'm never going to forget the Gorman national anthem after this. And these are things that I don't think other Star Wars properties necessarily accomplish, other than being like, all right, this is the third desert planet, and they pretty much have the same kind of desert planet culture that we've seen from all the other desert planets. Or it's like, what is the unique inhabitants of this biome?
Right.
You know, like the Ewoks. There is a real sense that the galaxy sort of comes alive a little bit. And I think that the great benefit here is we're not chasing around wizards with laser swords. Like we're just dealing with the lives of people trying to fight back against fascism. And sure enough, very relevant to our real world at this point.
I think part of the great unexplored areas of all Disney IP is just the people. Like the monologue in Kevin Smith's Clerks about contractors on the Death Star is what gets us to Andor eventually. Because you know what George Lucas doesn't give a shit about? Contractors on the Death Star. But Andor's like, what if all of those people, where did we get the resources for this Death Star?
Sure.
And, you know, what sort of people had to be subjugated to get these resources out into space to keep everything a secret? I think those are the super fun questions. And maybe Star Wars is the best place to have these sorts of series because we've had decades to think about these things. Before like the Disney shows even came out, I used to tell people like it's kind of insane that if you watch the cantina scene from A New Hope Star Wars, there's just a bunch of crazy aliens. And now, thanks to years and years of Star Wars canon, I know the names of most of those aliens, or I know where I could look to find the names of most of those aliens. Some of them have extensive backstories,
right? Like, you know, like, where some of them came from, like what planet they came from and how they ended up in the cantina. And
Star Wars gave us like our first quote unquote expanded universe that didn't really have to do anything with canon. And then Disney's like, no, what if everything's canon? Which, you know, probably because that was successful for Marvel at the time. But I do really think the cool thing about Andor is it's just about people, like you were saying. If right. it's space wizards, there's other bars to hurdle. Sure. But if it's just about people, there are interesting questions to ask.
Yeah. I think. You have to find someone like Tony Gilroy, who is interested in the contractors on the Death Star and is also interested in making like a very grounded, tactile show that is, you know, achieves those sort of things we expect of a good prestige TV show, right? Mm-hmm. Great performances, great meticulous production design, real locations. Like, I feel like the other thing that is very successful about Andor, even compared to like The Mandalorian, is that it feels like a very lived in world, which is very important to Star Wars, right? That is very important to those original trilogy of Star Wars movies. And I think a very important thing to keep in mind is to like why there was a mixed reaction to the prequels, which is like one of the reasons that people were put off a little bit by the prequels in the early 2000s, for those of us who are old enough to remember this, is that the George Lucas went a little crazy with the CGI and the digital environments. And it was such a departure from this world that he built in the original trilogy that felt real and lived in and alive, like the cantina is a great example. And I feel like Andor brought us back to that original feeling, but in a way that you can accomplish with, you know, all of the new techniques and technology that exists today. And I think that that's another reason why it resonated, especially with adult audiences who have been living with Star Wars their entire lives, right? You know, kids aren't going to get it. But for those of us, you know, who've been watching those same original Star Wars movies for 30 plus years of our life, it's very refreshing to be like, oh, awesome. The streets of Ferrix feel like a place that you could be. Right? Or the square in Gorman feels like a real place in this world.
Mine was tuning into the beginning of Andor season 2 and being like, there's corn in the Star Wars universe? I didn't know they had corn. There's I thought we had to go to the New World to get
Iowa?
Corn. Have they spread? Is it native to that planet? Is Mina Rao where our corn comes from?
Sure. Tell me more about these machines that harvest the corn.
Yeah, very frequently I have been startled by the majesty of the fantasy elements of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. I am always surprised when my brain's like, oh yeah, I guess I never thought about it, but that's the first time we've seen corn. Mm-hmm. Like, what a time to be a Star Wars fan.
Well, it's the first time we've seen them actually make the food that they eat.
They actually made the food. It's not just powder that Rey adds water to. Or Yoda's stew, which does look better than Luke sure. gives it credit for.
But it's this idea of, you know, taking this property, this fantasy series that is mostly for children, and taking its world seriously in yes. a way that will resonate with adults and infusing it with ideas that resonate with us sort of universally, political ideas, dramatic ideas, and again, populating it with characters that feel alive and feel real and in many ways are just like really hot, like yeah. really, really attractive people. Mm-hmm. So
I do helps. Like that for Star Wars in general, usually yeah. pretty attractive. And then the Star Wars post Disney, pretty attractive and different ethnicities and some women. It's been really, we've been really living.
Sure. We are eating well. And again, we hope that they learn the right lessons from this and are like, well, let's trust creators. Let's find creators that have really interesting visions for shows like this within our world, within our story world. And let's give them whatever they need to make their shows. But we'll see. Right. It's yeah. equally as possible, again, that we look back 10 years from now and are like, man, what a time we used to live in a real country where we had shows like Andor.
Yeah. Remember when we had Andor and they would just be like, yeah, we'll just do some droids and we'll just build an entire set of a square and yeah, digital extensions for everything else. And it's great. It's like, yeah, it's insane.
Yeah. And they're like,
We don't need any Jedi. I think that's all I want to talk about in terms of like the business side of this series. But
sure.
If you were Disney, what's like the over and under on Emmys that Andor has to get tomorrow before you consider doing another adult Star Wars?
Ooh, good question. How many Emmys did it get in the first season? It did get nominated for a bunch of creative Emmys. It was 6 creative Emmys and 3 primetimes. It got nominated, season one got nominated for Outstanding Drama Series. It got nominated 1 directing nomination and a writing nomination. I feel like it's just got to do better than that. It's got to get more than 3. Like, let's see some improvement. Then again, I mean, it depends on how you look at it, right? How much more money did they spend on season 2 than season 1? Like, with the two seasons are fairly even as far as their cost, then I would say it just has to do a little bit better, right? And get nominated for best drama series.
Yeah.
But I also think that given the media environment, given the reception of season 2, given the resonance of its themes to our real world that we're seeing, it's going to get more.
Yeah. I mean, yeah,
it's going to get more than 3.
I think 3's a good over under. I do think the bare minimum is best drama series nom. If they don't get a nomination for best drama series, that's it for some adult Star Wars television, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I do think that if it like gets nothing at the primetime Emmy Awards, like gets no nominations, that's a big loss.
I think creative Emmy's great. I think primetime Emmy's definitely best drama series. I would hope maybe a couple directors. I think it's going to get smoked in all the acting categories just because we have like a fucking Severance and a White Lotus this season.
Sure. Although you'd love to see some of these actors poke through because this cast, especially the core cast, has been really great across 2 seasons. And you would hope that the Emmy voters and committees reward, especially now that the show is over, right? We see this with final seasons a lot. Mm-hmm. Now that the show is completed its final season, maybe they take that into account and sort of give them the makeup award for not giving them any nominations previously. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. It's going to be packed. I don't know. I would put in a Genevieve O'Reilly over a Kathy Bates Matlock, but I haven't watched Matlock, so maybe it's going to go a different way.
Sure. Also, Matlock's going to get like 50 seasons. It's on CBS. True.
We've got some more times for Kathy Bates, who right. I think has already won an Emmy. Let's move on to some superlatives. Let's talk about our favorite Andor things. Neil has come up with some great categories. We have come through up with answers. These answers are across both seasons of Andor. So even though we're wrapping up season 2, we're really wrapping up the entirety of Andor. So they could come from everywhere. Neil,
mm-hmm.
Your first category is the Audience Died of a Broken Heart Award. So this is the best death or heartbreaking moment. Who did you pick?
Well, I didn't just want to go with best death because I feel like, you know, there are several really great exits in this show, but there's also just some big moments where like a lot of people die.
Yeah.
And I think that those are extremely powerful. And I also think that there are many characters who die and then their big moment comes like right after they die. Like I was rewatching the finale of season 1 earlier today. And I was reminded that like Marva, her big moment comes like the episode after she dies, when she gives her big speech in hollow form. So, I wanted to make sure that we could recognize the moments. Mine, of course, is, Gambo Dum Gore. We are the Gore. It is, essentially as they are singing, right before it's the Gorman Massacre. You guys know what I'm talking about here. But for me, it's like the rising tension of the moment that is heartbreaking, right? It is as the crowd begins singing and we are recognizing as the audience what is about to happen, right? Mm-hmm. We see the stormtroopers boxing them in. We see the Gorman people banding together in sort of this last moment of solidarity around their anthem. And then the worst thing happens, you know, like the thing we knew was coming happens, right?
Yeah.
The thing that the entire first portion of that season had been building toward happens. And it's terrible and awful. And then all the way up to the point where they get that like radio broadcast, it's so heartbreaking that I couldn't even enjoy the moment where they defeat K2SO, that what will become K2SO. And like me knowing that like that's eventually going to become Cassian's like buddy, right? And like you can't even enjoy it because the whole thing's so fucking sad. And yeah, I just thought like the Gorman Massacre is something I think that Star Wars fans will not soon forget. And for all the kids that are out there enjoying their Ahsokas and their skeleton crews and their Grogu plushies, yeah, it's only a matter of time before they get to the Gorman Massacre.
Yeah.
And get their whole souls smashed.
Presidential history is all fun and games, but eventually you get to Reagan and it's all downhill from there. I love that moment. I love the gore. I am sad that season two is a very slow train wreck on the gore, who are really trying their best and are just boxed out by the Empire and Cassian's weird sure. take on rebellion.
They didn't ask for that. They didn't ask to be born on top of all of that Kalkite.
Exactly. They just wanted to mine their spider silk like normal people.
They just wanted to make clothes.
My audience side of a broken heart award goes to a season one moment where we learn that Andy Serkis's Kino Loy, after leading a rebellion on Arcana 5, cannot swim. Nobody took the plan that far to mention that that's how they're all going to get out of there. There's a big triumphant score moment because everybody's finally getting out of Narcana 5, and you see Kino Loy stop and you see him say he can't swim and Andor has to jump off, and that's the last time we're probably ever going to see Kino Loy.
Mm-hmm.
So I
open-ended heartbreak.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I want that to end. Like, does he jump off and drown? Because this is a long swim. If sure. you see the Narcana 5, and if you can't swim, like, you're going to panic, and panic people pulls more people down. Or do I want him to be there when the Empire eventually like locks it back down? They're just going to kill him.
Sure.
So like,
or put him back in prison.
Or put him back in prison. It's just sad all the way around. I can't swim. What a single line to just immediately add devastation to an episode that has some great stuff in it otherwise.
Yeah. Well, and another great example of like, it's not just about the individual devastation of one character. Like, this is at the end of this incredible sequence where many people have died. Mm-hmm. And going into this off-screen sequence where we're pretty sure a bunch of other people are going to die too. Like, not everybody's going to make it in the water.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and all they're trying to do is just get free of this prison that's another episode I rewatched this week in preparation for this. Cause I was like, we're definitely gonna be talking, No Way Out or One Way Out. Sorry. And you know, you're reminded of just how prescient and relevant that whole, like, that whole storyline is, where it's all about finding ways to basically scam these prisoners into never leaving prison.
Yeah. Or Kino Loy's speech where he's like, you got to help each other to get out, but then he can't swim. Just you know what? That's how you deploy irony. Mm-hmm. Suck on it, Alanis Morissette. I can't swim. Kino Loy can't swim. That's how you do it.
That is ironic.
That is ironic. So that's going to be my heartbreak award. I almost went slightly less serious, but I also think everything B2Emo says is engineered to make us feel sad.
Oh, yeah, man. When he's like, Cassian will be home tomorrow. Like, every time he's like, Cassian will be home tomorrow. It's like, oh, God damn it.
Oh, God. Why are you doing this? Why do you make me think about droids having feelings? That seems counterintuitive to having droids.
Cassian is never coming home.
Let's get a little less serious, but a little more intense, as we have the award for the best polygons, or the ILM Sizzle Reel Award. Really just lots of sizzle reels. I've been watching the new sizzle reels for Scanline and stuff this week that have been coming out. What was your favorite effect sequence from Andor?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this in the context of pretty much every Star Wars. It's funny because, you know, we just spent a lot of time talking about, like, what is the strategy on Disney mm-hmm. Plus and what is the value of some of these shows. Some of it is this. Some of it is letting the visual effects people just kind of go off every once in a while, right? Because ILM, you know, is an in-house effects company. And you know, they're not the only ones that work on these shows, but they do a lot of it. And sometimes it's just about letting them do their thing. And in this case, in my choice, which is from season one, and is sort of controversial because it's a new ship that I think is, as the video gamers would call it, OP for mm-hmm. the universe. But it was so satisfying when Luthen Rael unveils what his ship can do as he's being pursued by an Imperial patrol. Like, he shreds their satellite. Then he roasts an entire group of TIE fighters with, like, lasers that come out the side. Kind of like the whole, what was it, from Iron Man 2, where he, like, does the things out the, mm-hmm. the, like, the first time he does the laser spin. Fantastic stuff. So for me, it's when Luthen's ship first pops off. And it's probably good that nobody knows where that ship is, because it's way more powerful than any other ship.
Yeah, right. I could take down a Death Star with just that ship.
Yeah, right. Like, it's not a fair fight between his ship and that entire patrol group.
You take Luthen's ship into a trench, and then you peel the Death Star like an orange, just and just take it down.
But it looks incredible, right? Like, looks like $1 billion. It's amazing. It
does. Mine also looks like $1 billion. You know mm-hmm. what?
This also from season category. One.
Yeah, also from season one. This is a hard category because lots of this stuff looks like $1 billion. And then also a lot of the stuff in season two is what we would call, like, invisible effects. Like, all the stuff that they shoot with, like, Luthen meeting people in Coruscant, those are all real places that they're just taking support beams away and adding backgrounds and stuff. So there's mm-hmm. a ton of visual effects stuff that is supposed to be invisible. But that being said, I do think that my visual effects moment was actually with the first season. I was like, oh, this series is going to actually be good. It's the escape from Aldani during the Eye, mm-hmm. where they're, like, flying and the TIE fighters are chasing them and Nemec is guiding him out. But, like, not only is that an amazing sequence during takeoff, but the whole TIE fighter chase happens above the cloud cover, but below the, like, meteors that are causing the Eye. And just, like, that sort of battle slash action sequence that's happening. I'm pretty sure they're using the volume because this is Andor season one, so big time volume era. Mm-hmm. But, like, they're using the volume and rendering this type of flight in such a great way. In atmosphere, TIE fighters were used to be a big thing until Disney era, and now I completely accept them, and I actually think they're kind of creepier there. And then, yes, just the colors, the action, the textures, the reflections in the different parts of the ship, the windows all around them constantly showing the action, that reflecting off the actors' faces. If it wasn't the volume, then it was the most, like, reactive lighting work I've seen done in one sequence in a long time.
Yeah.
So I think that's, not only does it have a lot of great models, because obviously it's a whole bunch of ships, but it has some great sets, has some great visual effects melding with those sets, and chef's kiss for me.
All of these exceptional from conception to execution is just all high level. Here's the thing, Dave. Normally we do, like, best and worst polygons, but I left worst off the list because honestly I could not think, and this is to the show's credit, I couldn't think of anything where in this show where I was like, this stands out as, like, an eyesore special effect. There might be some, like, compositing, even then. Right. Like I was rewatching in One Way Out. There's the sequence where Luthen is talking to Lonnie. He gives his like big speech. And like I can tell that that's mostly digital, pretty much all digital. And like those actors may not have even been in the same room. But it doesn't look bad. Like it doesn't, it's not like, it doesn't like take you out. I honestly could not think of any moment in these two seasons of television, which is impressive, that were like bad polygons or that I would consider to be a worst.
Yeah. I mean, if I had to do, damn, that is hard.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, maybe the sort of beast on Yavin 4 in the first series of season 2, but like, I don't see enough of that to know. And it's a space beast. So I kind of feel dumb for being like, oh, the thing that obviously wasn't there. So yeah, if most of the thing looks fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I feel like the show does a really excellent job of knowing when something needs to be, you know, full visual effects shot, like stuff like the eye or all the stuff in space, and putting a ton of effort into that. And then there's a lot of really sneaky, good set extension stuff, especially like you said in season 2, where it's like they built a lot of sets and most of the visual effects are like, we're in the Gorman Plaza and they just kind of, they just have to animate TIE fighters flying overhead.
Yeah.
And it's great. Like that's a easy, you know, that's an easy day over there at ILM.
Our next award is going to be the on-screen series MVP. This is the best performance in the series. Tough one. Neil, who'd you pick?
Well, it was a really tough one because you stole mine.
Well, you have my backup, so I'm glad we're representing both of these people.
And listen, I think it really came down to the wire who was going to be my second pick, because it could have been Stellan Skarsgård. He's really good as Luthen Rael. And I think especially in season 2, that character really comes to life in new and interesting ways, especially once we get to the flashback episode. But Genevieve O'Reilly, I mean, I think this is an Emmy worthy performance easily. And on top of that, it is taking, you know, transferring a character from the movies and fleshing out a pre-existing character, which I think is, again, one of the more difficult things for a show like this to pull off, right? You're competing against a bunch of characters in this show that start from scratch, right? So with Mon Mothma, you have many, many layers of story and legacy to compete against and something to really live up to. And I feel like they kind of start slow in season 1 with Mon Mothma. And then she just roars at the end with that speech. And Genevieve O'Reilly is really fantastic. Like, you know, there are specific moments, especially in season 2, the dance at the end of that one episode where she's dancing at the wedding, and then her giving her speech at the Senate, that I'm like, these are high level iconic Star Wars moments that if you're a person who watches all of the Star Wars things, these are probably, you know, in like your top 10, 15 moments of the entire franchise.
I would have also given it to Genevieve O'Reilly if we were just doing season 1, because she really made that storyline more interesting, I think, than it had any right to be.
Sure.
The sort of like, oh, we have weird marriage traditions. Also, I need to move my family money without raising the banks. Like, you know, Star Wars isn't super great with its banking plots. So the fact that she was able to make that, you know, sort of land and hit home, and that I was looking forward to Mon Mothma scenes in season 1, even though it was just about domestic kerfuffles for the most part.
And it was worth it because, you know, you get huge payoffs for that storyline in season 2.
Absolutely. Mine goes to Denise Gao, or Dedra Miro.
Hell yeah.
Who is just maybe my favorite Imperial. Mm-hmm. There is a female Imperial Admiral, I believe, called Admiral Rae Sloan, who exists in the novels and whatnot, your Star Wars aftermaths, was important in the Empire and in the New Republic era, the rise of the First Order. Rae Sloan was around. And for a long time, I was like, we need to have Rae Sloan in live action because we need to have like a female Imperial who has like real clear personality benefits and clear personality deficits. We need like a female Tarkin. And I think we got that in Dedra Miro, in that I get why she wants to do what she wants to do. She wants to do the best at where she is. She sees, and I think why she gets together with Cyril is she sees a lot of the waste of the Empire sort of like getting in the way of the, what she thinks should be the goals of the Empire. And I just love how at the end of the first season, even though I absolutely hated her, she seemed to be spared. And then the second season just continued to be more evil. Just this time under the guise of, so you and I could be together, Cyril. But it was always just a base evil. I love the detail in the Empire. I think it's really smart. I get the point of the optics of the original trilogy, where it's just like, they're all white human men and they're British. But now that we move beyond that, Dedra Miro might be my favorite Imperial.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to, I mean,
she's got layers, man.
Yeah, we all love Piet, but not as much as we love Dedra Miro.
Yeah, no, and listen, it's a great performance. I mean, I'm very biased because, as I've mentioned several times, Denise Goff's voice, because I've played The Witcher 3 several times, lives like in my soul because she voiced Yennefer. But man, end to end, just sensational performance. And I think really goes to something that's very important about these kinds of Star Wars stories, because Andor, again, one of the things we praised it for is not having to go and bring in a Palpatine or a Vader, right? They bring in Ben Mendelsohn at the end, but that felt like that was going to happen no matter what, right? He's very important to the plot of this story and obviously Rogue One. But this, every good Star Wars thing needs a good villain, right? And it needs a villain, I think, that is not just someone who is working against our hero, but someone who we, not that we empathize with her necessarily, although we do at certain points along her journey. Like I, especially at the end, I empathize with the fact that she was just kind of like a nerd who got caught up being curious about the Death Star, right? Like, I feel bad that she ends up in prison a little bit because, like, I don't know, man, she was just doing research and she kind of stumbled on, and, you know, it worked out for the rebellion. That's great. But, you know, it's a character that has multiple layers. It's a character that has a great deal of nuance. It's a character that, you know, we're almost rooting for her relationship to work for a while there. It's interesting at the very least. And, you know, I don't at any point regret spending time with that character because she is interesting every moment that she's on screen and compelling as an antagonist to our many, many, many lovable rebels.
Maybe we'll be talking a little bit more about Neil and Dedra Miro as we go through the podcast. But
sure.
First, we have to do our Below the Line series MVP. This is something we also do on our Dave and Neil's Pop Culture Adventure every week when we talk about a movie, is we try to spotlight some people who aren't the ones being selling the series on their name. So, Neil, who did you pick for your Below the Line series MVP?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm taking Nicholas Britell, who's the composer on season one, who I think, you know, one of the things that sticks out to me about these successful, or at least in my mind, successful Disney Plus shows is that I can hear the scores in my head when I think about them, right? When I think about The Mandalorian season one, I think about Ludwig Göransson's score and how unique that felt in the Star Wars universe, right? And I feel like that is, you know, that's the John Williams, like, not every Star Wars score has to be John Williams, but they kind of have to be memorable, like a John Williams score, like John Williams' original score.
But that was the every score needed to be that. We just say John Williams because John Williams is really good at it. But that's what you're looking for in a score.
But you're looking for something that really sets the tone and really, you know, spells out the vibe for what you're going for. And I think Nicholas Britell in season one absolutely did that. It carries over in season two with who was the second composer? I had his name pulled up. Brandon Roberts, who took over for him in season two. You know, and the season two score is good. Nicholas Britell also gets a co-writing credit for the Gorman anthem, which he and Tony Gilroy wrote the words to. And so I feel like that is a very key element to the success of season two. So I feel like, you know, if you're trying to make a Disney Plus Star Wars series that's great, you got to have a banger score, especially in your first season, to make people think, oh, this is feels like a Star Wars thing, but also has its own unique vibe. And the score can push that along very well.
Yeah, I remember watching Andor season one and like a couple episodes in and seeing on the internet that all the Andor season one openers can overlap with each other because he's using different instrumentations. And so finally, when they all came out, they're like, here's all the Andor themes at once. And I'm like, fucking epic.
Dave, I love it. If you like Nicholas Britell's work, he also did this little show called Succession.
Oh,
that is I'm a big fan personally.
I mean,
also very good score.
Succession. I hear that show is good and that those very good people have started working on the Harry Potter series today. So I'm aware I need to Succession up here somewhere in the future. My Below the Line series MVP goes to Luke Hull, that series production designer, a.k.a. World Builder Supreme. I just love this. It's definitely there in the first season, but I think it really shines in season two, just as like we get to go really deep into Gorman. We get to go really deep into Coruscant. I think that's just as interesting as seasons one, leaping around to all these very distinct planets with very distinct looks. But like you were saying, and, you know, praising the non-biome based Star Wars, I do think it's the work of Luke Hull and the production design team that in like season two made that whole Gorman set and that you could walk in and out of and have different sets in the full set. That's a tough thing to pull off, but he pulls it off and it might definitely one of my favorite TV series production designers, just with how much they have to adapt and with how little, especially in season two, we use the same sets over and over again, but because there was such a variety to sprinkle in amongst it, I didn't mind that we were going back to the safe house, or I didn't mind that Yavin 4 kept developing, because I do think there were pieces around it to sort of make each return to a place feel different, which to me elevated a little bit more than, like, I appreciated going back to Ferrix in season one, but Ferrix didn't really change until Rick's Road, the finale of season one, where they packed it with Imperials and packed it with people. And then I was like, oh, this set has always been amazing. I didn't feel that until like the very end.
Sure.
But season two, I think straight all the way through, I would change nothing about the production design.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there's an element, especially because season one was produced like in the heart of the pandemic, where there wasn't as much building, right? You mentioned they were using the volume a little bit more. In season one, which, you know, those limitations are very real. And I still think they made a brilliant season of television despite all of that. But you can definitely see where in pre-production of season two, they were like, all right, Luke Hull, time to cook.
Go.
Like, go build some stuff.
Go build it.
And he was like, all right.
And did.
All right, Disney, give me the money truck and I'll do it.
All right, here comes the big awards. It's best episode. Neil, what is the best episode of Andor?
Well, I think I might have telegraphed this last week because it was one of the episodes we talked about, but it's Make It Stop, the Luthen Kleya episode.
The episode without Cassian Andor.
The episode without Cassian. But again, it's this rare kind of episode that, you know, we didn't really talk about it much earlier, but like, this, I think, was the one episode that made me wish they were going week to week with each individual episode. Because this is the kind of episode I would have wanted to talk about for a whole week. Because it's the kind of episode that recontextualized entire storylines, right? From multiple characters, including Kleya, who up to that point was
the assistant. You know,
it was the assistant. She was important, but not central. right? She was important to Luthen's story and important to the rebellion in the sense that she was like the communications hub of the entire operation. But when you really think about it, once you get out of that episode, you're like, she's the rebellion. You know, like when by the time she gets to Yavin, it's like she built this, right? Like you could substitute in Cassian's big speech at the end where he's like, none of this is possible without Luthen. You could substitute Clea's name in there too, because, you know, she ultimately is kind of the one that drove Luthen. And I think that that episode, especially that late in the game, especially the way that episode is structured to where it kind of sets you up to think it's one thing and then hits you with a bunch of flashbacks to become something completely different. And then, you know, has this whole different like spy thriller, you know, situation that she goes through and turns out she's the best spy of them all. Fantastic. Top to bottom, great episode. I can't imagine a better episode of Star Wars television than that. Although I will say, having rewatched the finale of season one, it was kind of close. Like that season one finale is really good. That Rick's Road episode.
Yeah. I also rewatched that recently, and I was having the conversation with Java if it would easily be Rick's Road for me if Marva actually said, fuck the Empire. If we got our first F-bomb like we were supposed to, I would be like, Rick's Road, right up there with like The Last Jedi, like all time Star Wars moments. Where were you when Marva said, fuck the Empire? I would do it. But I do think Make It Stop is an excellent choice, again, for like what you were saying, where it takes this rolling series of like, we're going to touch in with this rebellion every couple of years, and it sort of like takes a stop on it and makes a character focused episode. Mm-hmm. And you kind of don't realize it's Clea's episode until about halfway through is the brilliance of it, I think. And I love it. I love Make It Stop. But it's not my answer, because my answer is from season one, and it's One Way Out. You get two great monologues. You get Kino Loy's monologue as the prison escape's happening. You get Luthen talking to Lani about burning his life. And you get this triumphant moment that once again is punctuated with my saddest line, I can't swim. One Way Out arc, it ends obviously with the prison escape. But since we spend so much time in that prison, earning the trust of Kino Loy, figuring out how to get out of this seemingly impossible prison situation and trying to escape, the catharsis, I think, is really great. It is the reverse catharsis you have in the Gorman episodes, I think, which is right before we come in to land the season plane, something gigantic happens. And in One Way Out, we get a hint that maybe these guys, you know, have a way forward. Maybe the little guy can fight the Empire. All it takes is the power of many. Maybe Nemec's going to be right anyway. And it doesn't really end that way, because we have more years to go until your episodes Make It Stop. But I do think that's probably the time in Andor where I had like the most hope, because the eye escape is good, but Nemec does get crushed by credits. So it's not all great as it's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this is fantastic choice. Rewatching it, I was reminded of how much other stuff happens. Other very pivotal stuff happens in this episode other than the prison break, right? Like you mentioned the Luthen Lani conversation, which I think is like one of the most important scenes of season one, but also like the Mon Mothma Davos Skulden stuff that I didn't think was super important at the time, but turns out to be hugely important for season two, right? The wedding becoming, you know, sort of like fulcrum point for her storyline in season two is really interesting. And I mean, it's like a jam-packed full of huge turning points for a lot of characters episode, you know, and you got Andy Serkis over here just showing off those acting skills,
just gravelly voicing his way just through,
crushing it,
getting out of there. And now it's the super important ones again, the dead speak, the line of the series. Oh man, Neil. Mm-hmm. I think somehow our line of the series both can come from the same episode.
Me too.
So why don't you go first?
Well, mine comes from a character we have not name checked at all yet. Probably since we talked about season one, because he's barely in the series. But it comes from Clem Andor, Andor's adopted father, Cassian's adopted father, who says in flashback form, "The man who sees everything is more blessed than cursed." This is something I think about a lot, this idea, right? About, especially even like in like real life sometimes, which is this idea of like being aware of things that are bad, right? Like, would I rather go through my life ignorant of the political realities of human existence in the time that I live, right? Would you rather be someone like Cassian Andor, who sees the Empire for what it is and is compelled to fight against it ultimately? Or would you rather be just a lemming who you don't have to be like Cyril or Dedra or like somebody who's actively participating in the fascism, or you could just be somebody who just like doesn't think about it. Right. And sometimes as someone who feels like he does see things for what they are right here in 2025 America, it feels like a curse at times, right? It feels like a curse to be awakened to the truth of many things. But as Clem says, it actually is a blessing, because it means that you have a certain amount of human empathy, and that you have the ability to just have like a life literacy that other people don't have, that, you know, even though it makes you sad, right, the state of the world or mm-hmm. the existence of things like a fascist empire, it's better to know and be able to try and work against those things than to be blissfully unaware and maybe be just like some random silk farmer on Gorman who gets murdered.
Yeah, don't want to be that.
Yeah, right. You know, like, you're either that guy or maybe you're Cassian. I, in the end, would rather be Cassian, I think. And I think that's part of the Cassian Andor journey, is that it's about him not only recognizing what the Empire is, but recognizing his own power in the situation as a dude who does not have a laser sword.
Yep. Mine is a part of Nemec's manifesto, the Trail of Political Consciousness. It airs several times throughout the series because I think it's important, but more, I think, spotlighting it for me is Tony Gilroy said after season one that the scene of Andor committing to the manifesto on Ferrix is probably his favorite thing he did in season one. So here's the section I want to say is the line of Andor, which is, "The Imperial need for control is desperate because it is so unnatural. Tyranny requires constant effort. It breaks, it leaks. Authority is brittle. Oppression is the mask of fear. Remember that and know this. The day will come when all these skirmishes and battles, these moments of defiance, will have flooded the banks of the Empire's authority, and there will be one too many. One single thing will break the siege. Remember this. Try." And what is Andor, if not a dozen or so perfectly valuable attempts at rebellion, finally coalescing to bring down the Death Star?
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things needed to happen. Everybody needed to try. Some people needed to die, but that's what it took to eventually bring down the Empire in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah. I mean, it's a story ultimately about the people who keep trying anyway, even though terrible shit keeps happening to them, you know?
I mean, but so is the documentary No Other Land. If you watch it, there's an amazing sort of like resiliency to oppressed people that I think they really hit on the head here in a fucking Star Wars, which is why I love it. And while I will remember it, I don't know, I don't want to say long after Andor. I'm a media guy. I remember lots of stuff, but I'm going to remember it. This is the fun one. We're going back. Our other awards are all fun, I promise. This is the I'm Ready for My Spinoff Award, where we're each going to choose a single character that we'd like to see a show built around. We both did not choose a single character. Neil, who did you pick?
Well, I mean, it starts with a single character. But you, I mean, you can't do a Star Wars with just one character. Mine, I mean, I think I mentioned this last week. So again, kind of another cheat. But Dedra makes it. She's a compelling character. She knows a lot about Death Stars. We know that there's more than one Death Star. So I would like to know if Dedra Miro ever interacts with any Bothans. And again, I think that if Disney and Lucasfilm view Andor as successful, and they think that these kinds of stories about the rebellion will be interesting to the adult audience that likes Star Wars, why wouldn't you just keep telling more stories about the people who are out there getting information about the second Death Star, right? Like, this could be an interesting formula where it's like, let's tell the story happening behind the story that you already know in these TV shows, you know, like let's tell these parallel stories. And as much as I like the idea of Star Wars branching out and going to different eras and telling me all about the Old Republic and whatever, these are also really interesting because like we spent quite a lot of time talking about what else is happening around the galaxy as these events are happening and how these things connect without ever having to have big cameos. So if you're going to do another show like that, give me Dedra and the Bothans and Death Star 2.
Yeah, Death Star 2. Just how do they build the second Death Star?
I've for a long time had lots of questions about Death Star 2 and like what was going on there, right? Like Rogue One and Andor have answered so many questions I did not know I had about the first Death Star.
Let's move on to the next one. My pick is Kleya and Vel post Yavin. And I don't mean necessarily post Yavin like in the original trilogy. I mean, like what happens after they win? Because it seems like they're kind of together on Yavin 4 at the end of Andor season 2. And I would love for these characters to get together, both the people who knew and appreciated what Luthen was doing and survive Rogue One. But I think it's additionally interesting that Vel is Mon Mothma's cousin and she becomes the leader of the New Republic. And as soon as Mon Mothma becomes the leader of the New Republic, she disbands the National Army. So they don't have a standing army. That's her way of sort of like keeping peace. But they do need to build a republic. And as we saw in The Mandalorian, some of that is difficult. Some planets don't want to be part of it. So I would be interested in Kleya and Vel to. It's essentially a Cold War story from spies that had been World War II spies.
Sure.
Like they were really good spies. The war is over. There's still enemy out there, but we can't actually like legally fight them. Are Kleya and Vel going to take a spy route? Are they going to go after Moff Gideon and his Imperial remnant? Or are they going to try to politically go through the correct channels and try to see if the New Republic works? In which case, do we spend more time on Chandrilla, the new capital of the New Republic? But either way, these are two female characters that I think are great additions to the base of the rebellion.
Yeah.
So we now know, you know, like they definitely were part of it. They'll be part of it canonically, probably forever. I don't need to see how they die. I just need to see if they survive the Galactic War or the Galactic Rebellion. What world do they live in there? If they live to see the world that they wanted, which is ultimately what a lot of our rebels don't get to do, what does that do to somebody who, you know, lost Cinta at Gorman, who lost Luthen to the Empire. So I'd be interested to see what happens to them. And I think it would be a fun way to do another creeping fascism, because unfortunately in Star Wars, the Empire disappears and almost immediately both the Imperial Remnant and the First Order get started.
Sure.
So I think it would still be politically beneficial for us as America if we survive the next couple of years
I almost think it's like a metaphor for how Nazism never goes away.
It does seem like that.
But I also love this pairing narratively, because it also gives you an opportunity to play with two different perspectives going forward in the rebellion, right? We have Vel, who I think is maybe more accepted and more actively and earnestly involved in the rebellion, right? Because she's Mon Mothma's cousin, and because she was like involved with the Gorman rebels, and like, you know, we kind of see where they're at the end of Andor, right? Vel's sitting at the lunch table with all the rebels. Clea is kind of an outcast on Yavin and doesn't even think she wants to be there, and doesn't think that anyone likes her because of how close she was with Luthen. And I think that that would be an interesting dynamic to explore. And also, you know, exploring Vel's story into the future gives us more space lesbians, and you know, you can never have too many of those.
Yeah, I mean, these two could become space lesbians. I mean,
we don't know much about Clea in that regard. She's been all business so far, but
I could see like an episode one where Mon Mothma needs something done, but there's no fucking army, so she can't do anything. She's like a figurehead. So she turns to her cousin and they're like, hey, you want to do a little off the books mission for me? And Vel's like, only if I could bring in this ace. Cut to desert planet, because that's where everybody hides.
Sure.
Clea in a desert planet. And Vel rolls up and is like, you thought our fight was over. And then
sure.
We do a Star Wars story.
Or if you want to be really bold, not a desert planet.
not a desert planet.
If you want to signal to the audience that this show like fucks on a different level, put her on a planet that has trees.
Or they put it on Naboo, but it's Naboo post Operation Cinder, so it's just a desert again. Not important. Our next award, or our final award for this wrap up, goes to the Glup Shitto Lives Award. This is a name that they made up for Andor that is a ridiculous Star Wars name. I didn't, for trivia this time, did I make this Star Wars name up, because Andor does have some ridiculous names. And even though I really wanted to, I didn't pick any of Andor's aliases because I do think they're all ridiculous.
Sure.
With the exception of Clem. Clem has an emotional backing, but the rest of them are ridiculous. So, Neil, who did you pick for your Glup Shitto Lives Award?
Well, I picked an Imperial officer who is on Eldani. He's actually the boss of, what was that guy's name that he was the boss of? He's the agent. He's like the double agent.
Oh, wasn't it?
And Eldani. Gorn. Yeah. So Gorn's boss, played by Irish actor. What's his name? Shit. I had his name all pulled up and everything. Anyway, Stanley Townsend is the actor's name.
The character's
name is Commandant J-Hold Behaz. J-Hold Behaz.
Mm-hmm.
Is his
husband to Robota Behaz and father to Leonard Behaz.
The whole Behaz clan is at, wait, they have their own Wikipedia pages? What's Leonard Behaz? What's his whole deal? What's he doing out here?
I mean, he was held captive during the siege of Eldani because they used the family against him.
Sure. Oh, played by Alfie Todd. Wasn't this kid in House of the Dragon? Yes, he was.
Willem Amazing. Blackwood. Blackwood.
He's little Willem Blackwood Star Wars dad. J-Hold Behaz.
I love that. Mine is a child.
Excellent. Because
Mon Mothma's daughter marries. I thought Davos Skulden was already like right on the line of like,
yeah,
too much. But his son is Stekken Skulden. And that is not a first name.
Stekken.
Let me just really quickly Google. But
maybe that's why she was so nervous right there at the wedding. She didn't want to become Mrs. Stekken Skulden. She's like, I can't write that for the rest of my life on my highfalutin stationery.
Yeah, Leda
which
Mothma
I assume
is
they
so
have
nice.
In this culture.
So nice, and Stekken Skulden is so bad.
Yeah, her name was Leda Mothma. That was an awesome name.
Stekken Skulden, boo, change your name. Take her name. Take the Mothma name. I don't know.
Yeah, Stekken Mothma is actually not bad.
Stekken Mothma is like, that's a soccer player that I could get behind.
Sure. Also, if I understand it correctly, because I've watched Andor, the Skulden name, even though he's like a really rich guy, he's not well liked.
No.
Even in high society circles. So I think that Stekkan should have been very progressive in maybe taking his wife's name. It is a thing that happens and probably would have benefited him quite a lot because Mothma's got some juice going forward.
Yeah. And you don't want to be walking around while there are space Nazis around with the monograms SS on all of your fucking clothes. So Stekkan, get it together.
It's just my name.
It's just too bad. Too bad, Adolf. Maybe talk to your parents.
Oh, boy.
Well, I'm glad we ended there, Neil, because sure. Next week we're going to, I'm sure, keep talking about Andor, but we're going to be doing a Star Wars politics special. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Make sure to tune in and figure out what that's about.
Plenty of Nazi talk next week.
I got so deep into an analysis of the prequel trilogy.
Hell yeah.
That I am very excited to talk to you next week about George W. Bush presidency.
Mm.
And then some original trilogy stuff. And then I would love to also, I know we haven't done many sequel trilogy shows because we were doing this podcast when they came out, but I would also love to have a little talk about, is Andor like the most political that Star Wars is going to be allowed to be?
Sure.
Here in Disney, where we've seen Disney sort of comply in advance to some scary shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
can't wait to get super political.
That's right. Tune in next week. So we're going to talk about Admiral Akbar, Darth Vader, Yoda, Jar Jar Binks, Boss
Nuclear
Mass,
proliferation.
Nuclear proliferation. George W. Bush saying you're either with him or against him. All of this and more next week on Storm of Spoilers. Until then, Neil, ignite the spark.
And do the other thing. Light the fire.